5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
When I had come down this hill, I had seen this creature cross the road. It would have ripped my locked door from my truck, extracted me from my vehicle, and there wouldn't have been a damn thing I could have done about it.
This thing, I got to notice its eyes. Its eyes was real, real evil, real sinister looking. You know, the look it was giving me.
7-1, what are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better... Sheriff, see ya!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh.
Welcome to Sasquatch Chronicles, a place where people share their encounters. Let's start the show. After a week long of fighting this head cold and Bobby fighting tornadoes and bad storms down there, we're finally able to sit down and have an interview. Bobby Hamilton is the co-founder of the GCBRO, and he's also one of the stars on the TV show Killing Bigfoot. And we're going to get into a little bit of that tonight, talking about the show. But I wanted to welcome you to the show, Bobby.
Well, thank you, Wes. I appreciate it. I've been looking forward to coming on here and talking to you and telling some of my encounters and the things that we've come across. We've kind of had trouble hooking up to do this, and I'm glad, the time has finally happened so we can get this done.
No, I appreciate it. And I wanted you, if you would, take my audience back to that day when you were a child. Talk about that night that you had that encounter, or maybe even if there's things that kind of led up to that encounter, could you talk about the things that actually led up to that encounter and then kind of walk us into that encounter when you were a child and you had one out at the window?
Okay. It was 1969. We lived on a farm in East Texas. It was the closest larger town was Nacogdoches, Texas. And it was the other side of Nacogdoches, kind of northeast of there. There was a little town called Garrison. We had moved there. We hadn't been there but a couple of months, and my dad, just so people can kind of understand, my dad worked offshore pipeline, and he was gone the biggest majority of the time. He would be gone for months at a time, then he would come in for a couple of weeks, and then he'd be gone again for several months at a time. And I'm not going to remember him being gone as long as 6 months at a time, and then come in for a couple of weeks, then he'd be gone again. He was all over the world, he was, in the North Sea and Gulf of Mexico. I mean, he was all over in the pioneering stages of the whole offshore pipeline deal. So anyway, he wasn't there a lot. And we had moved to this farm. I was a kid. I can't remember how many acres it was. I'll have to ask my mom to get this information for future reference. But it was a farm, and it was an old farmhouse. It had a barn. The barn was approximately 300 foot from the house is where about how far away the barn was. And we had, cattle, had a horse. It was your typical farm. In fact, we had also had chickens. We had a pen, inside the barn that had chickens in there. And I don't know if this thing ever got in the chickens. I really don't know, because we raised them up to where they was the eating size, and then you know, we, of course, we slaughtered them and put them in the freezer. But, my dad had bought this horse for my, my brothers and my sister. I have two brothers and a sister. And when we moved to this farm, shortly after we got there with the horse just went totally crazy. It was, the way it acted, it just wasn't acting right. And, it got to, it was so crazy to the point that nobody could ride the horse. I mean, it was, my dad said, I don't know what's going wrong with this horse. This thing just went crazy. And, he took a few shots at it with a rifle one time. I don't know what type of rifle it was. I was just a kid, but, cause he was trying to ride the horse. My brothers couldn't ride it. And my dad was going, you know, well, let me show you how to ride the horse. And he's trying to ride it. Well, the horse threw him. Well, his temper went through the roof. You know, that may not sit well with some people shooting at it, but I mean, it's just the way it was. Of course, he didn't actually hit the horse. He could have. He's a real good hunter. I mean, I think he was shooting in the vicinity, more than likely right behind the horse. But anyway, he was pretty fired up about the horse throwing him the way it did. But the horse went totally nuts. Well, he got rid of the horse. A lot of things happening around the house. We would hear things at night that, you know, it really, the things we was hearing, you know, it spooked my mom, and she thought somebody was prowling around outside. Nothing was ever really taken that we noticed, but she just, you know, she didn't know what it was, and she would, you know, shine a flashlight outside and turn on the outside light and look, and, you know, never seen anything, but, you know, something was around the house. And, you know, it spooked my mom. And, so the house was set up, get my direction straight here. In the northeast corner of the house was my mom and dad's room. And then if you come down the hall on the left was my sister's room. And the next room down was the boys' room. And then I come back up the hall on the other side of the hall from my sister's room. Was the restroom, and then the other side of the wall from there was the living room, and then the kitchen was, you know, across the hall from my parents' room was the kitchen, and we went out the back door from there, and then the front door was where the living room area was. It went out on the front porch. Anyway, this stuff was happening, and it was, you know, it was really spooking my mom. You know, my sister was a little uneasy, and we didn't know what was going on at the time. And,
what kind of things were happening, Bobby?
It was hearing things outside around the house, and things was bumping on the house, and, you know, nothing was ever seen, but, you know, they knew. I hadn't been 4 years old very long, and I've got an excellent childhood memory. A lot of people can't remember things from their childhood. I've sat here and told my mom things all the way back to 2 years old, and she's like, how do you remember that? I'm like, I remember my childhood just like it was yesterday. I remember so much stuff, you know. Uh-huh. But there was a lot of things bumping around outside. You could hear stuff moving outside, but they never seen anything. And I remember my brothers had come there from school, and they was talking about right down the road from the house, there was this creek that was about 6 foot across from bank to bank. And there was supposed to be a creature that was lurking around that area that could take one step from one side of that creek to the other and do it in one step and never step down into the creek. It could take a 6 foot stride and step across the creek. And the way they was talking is supposed to be in this hairy wild man type creature. And they took off on their motorcycles. My dad had bought them, my brother, my oldest brother, he had a Honda 90, and then my other brother had a Honda 50. And back then, that was, you know, they were street bikes, and it looks like the old bikes you see on the old early 70s motorcycle gang movies, and riding around in Hondas and stuff. It's one of those type of motorcycles. It looked like one of those. They went down the road one day, said they was going to go down there and see if they could see this creature. And they went somewhere down this other road off the main road down where this creek is supposed to be. And they was gone for a little while. And then they come flying back up the road and flew in the driveway, you know, running the house. And they was freaking all out. they said they was down there, and they started, you know, after a little while, you know, they were sitting there, and they heard something coming through the woods, and they caught a glimpse of something. They didn't know what it was, but, you know, they was already, you know, giddy and spooked anyway, you know, anticipating what they was going to see. They took off. My youngest brother, he's 7.5 years older than me. His motorcycle died, and the other one had left him, and he looked back and seen anyone there, and he turned around and went back and said, "Here, get on my motorcycle." And he got on it and got it fired up, and they come on to the house. Well, you know, they was all worked up about this. Nobody had put anything together about this might be what's coming up around the house. And it may not have been the same creature. I'm not saying it was, but, you know, nobody put the two together in any way. Mom was freaking out of everything that was, you know, going on around the house. So she would, at times, she would tell us, "Hey, kids, y'all sleep in here with me in my room." And when she would do that, my sister would sleep, with, you know, in the bed with my mom. My youngest brother, I'll go ahead and say his name's David, he would sleep at the foot of the bed, and there was a window over his head, and that, you know, and if you go by the window, that was the side of the bed my mom would sleep on. On the other side of the bed where my sister was sleeping, there was another window, and myself and my oldest brother, who was now 14 or 15 at the time, he's about 15, he was sleeping with me on the floor under that window. And, you know, his name is Gerald. I woke, you know, and it was getting close to the fall months, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't real cool, but it was mediocre cool. And we didn't have air conditioning, so we had the windows up. And I woke up in the middle of the night. I have no idea what time it is. And for some reason I was scared. I was terrified. And I guess this thing had been watching me, and I woke up with this weird feeling, but I just woke up totally freaking out. And I'm like, "Gerald, I got to go to the bathroom," take him to the bathroom. And he's like, "Just go ahead and go, you know, I'll be here when you get back." I'm like, "Look, I need you to walk me to the bathroom. I'm scared." And this, you know, went back and forth between me and him, you know, for about 5 or 6 times. "You look, please walk me to the bathroom." And he finally growled. He said, "Just go to the bathroom. I'll be awake when you get back." You know, and he kind of growled it out at me. And so I get up, you know, off our pallet that was sleeping on like a little whipped dog, you know, my head bowed down and easing down the hall, looking around the corners, you know, into the other rooms as I went by to go to the restroom. And I went in there and use the restroom, and the hall light was on, and I come walking back in to my mom's room, and the hall light was on behind me, and I had my head down, and I was just stepping into the room, and I heard a scratch on the window screen, and I'm not thinking anything at all, you know, and I just looked up because I heard this noise, and when I did, I guess it had to be a full moon out because you could see everything out there really well. This thing was right up in the window, and it had this demonic looking grin. I mean, I seen these teeth, and it was motioning for me with its hand to come to the window. And I looked at it, and my mind absorbed this thing, you know, and it's like, what the heck is this? You know, my mind is just going nuts at this point, and it probably took every bit of about 3 seconds, you know, for me to finally make a move. And I jumped to my left and jumped on top of my David, the one who's about, you know, like I said, I was 4, he was about 11. I jumped on top of him, and I didn't realize what I was doing because I went into just a panic. And I had grabbed him around the throat and was choking him, and I started screaming. Well, he felt me hit on him, and he started trying to raise up, and I'm choking him, and he's trying to get me off. Well, out of his corner of his peripheral vision, he seen something turn to run from the window. And, you know, he couldn't tell what it was, but he seen something turn to run from the window. He finally got me off of him, and I'm all hysterical. I've done woke up the whole neighborhood at this point because I'm screaming, you know, very, very wildly about, you know, this thing in the window. And anyway, Gerald and David, they grabbed some rifles. Because, you know, that's what country folks do. We, we hunt and we, you know, from a young age. So, you know, we know how to handle firearms and stuff. They grabbed two rifles and flashlights and went outside. They didn't see nothing. And, they come back in and, you know, it's, there's nothing out there. Are you sure? Yeah, there's nothing out there. Well, you know, did you look for tracks? Did you do this? I actually remembered asking if they seen any tracks out there. And, they said, you know, you could see where something had been under the window, you know, but, you know, they didn't find anything, you know, and I find it odd, you know, me being a kid, I asked them if they looked for tracks, and I'm like, you know, I'm thinking about it now. That is so strange to be that young and ask that, but I did. But anyway, they didn't find anything. They didn't see anything. And I was living with this fear then. I had this thing in me. Something was in the window trying to get me. It was a short time after that. Well, I had a calf. My dad had bought some cows, and he bought my David. He bought him a bull for FFA, for Future Farmers of America. And it's, you know, they got them into schools and stuff, you know, to teach kids about, you know, farming and, you know, all this stuff. And his project, he was raising this little bull, you know, to show and, you know, eventually sell. And what was at the sale barn, I had asked my dad, I said, look, I want a calf too. I want a calf too. Well, he bought me this little dairy calf and I named it Smokey. It was it was the most amazing calf. You know, to me, it was like my pet dog. I would pet this calf. I would walk out and right outside our back porch, you'd walk about 50 foot and there was the gate, and I would open the gate and walk out there, you know, and make my little whistling sound like Smokey, you know, and I'd come on Smokey, and he'd be off somewhere in the field, and it'd take me a little bit of doing that, but when he would hear me, he would come running across the field and run up to me, and I'd pet him. He was just like a pet dog, and you know, I think about it now, it's pretty amazing, because you know you just don't see that, and kids don't get to experience stuff like this anymore. But you know, This was my pet, and I've even got a picture of me with this calf, of me standing by this calf, you know, back then, and I need to get it scanned in and put it on the website. I woke up one morning, I got up, and of course I was in my mom's room, and I come out and walked towards the kitchen, and she, you know, and I was going to do one of my normal rituals, which I did on a pretty regular basis. I would go out back and holler for Smokey and pet him and just start, you know, being a kid outside. Well, as I was going through the kitchen, Mom told me, she said, Bobby, don't go out to the barn. And I'm like, why? And she said, just don't go out to the barn. And I couldn't understand why she wanted me to go out to the barn. Well, I run out the back door, and I run out to the barn. You know, I'm curious. I want to know what's going on. And as I rounded the corner going into the barn, my eyes picked up on the ground, you know, another horrific sight for a young kid to see. My calf was laying there with his insides. If you walked into the barn, his back was to the left. His guts was pulled out in a pile to the right. They wasn't stretched out in all types of directions. They was pulled out in a pile right there by him, approximately 2 foot from him in a pile to the right. And one thing I didn't say on setting up for this part of the story was my mom and my aunt, we had went to a town called Lufkin and did some shopping, and we come back, it was after dark. We heard something in the barn, and my mom and my aunt, mom went in and grabbed a pistol and going to walk out to the barn to see what was in there. Well, we followed my mom as she went out there. And we was a little ways back. She was telling us to go back to the house. Well, as they went to round into the barn, they heard something growl. And my mom and aunt screamed, and they all ran us back to the house. And I've asked Mom about it many times, and she said that she doesn't know what was in the barn. She didn't see it. But if she rounded the barn and was coming around with the flashlight to shine it in there, she said it was the most demonic growl she's ever heard in her life. And the only thing she could think of was she had to get out of there. And my mom, she grew up in Oklahoma, in southeast Oklahoma. There's an area up there called Winding Stair Mountain. And, you know, she grew up in, you know, some salt, you know, sawmill camps and stuff back there in the 30s and 40s. And so it's not like she's not familiar with animals and stuff like that, but this really scared. So I should have set that up, you know, before telling about my calf. But my dad, she talked to my dad on the phone, and he told her, he said, take the two German police dogs. We had two German police dogs. One was named King and one was named Princess. He said, put them in the barn, and they'll keep out whatever's in there. Up to this point, these dogs have not raised any type of cane. They haven't barked in the yard or anything else. They've done none of this. They was tied up behind the house, but they've never raised cane at night. She put them in the barn and tied them to the left side of the barn. And where they could stretch out and reach to was just shy of where the calf was. And Mom said, King and Princess, they killed Smokey. Well, if they killed Smokey, why was his back laying towards them and his guts pulled out in a nice pile the opposite direction of where they was at? You know, it didn't add up. None of this added up.
The two German Shepherds were actually in the barn while right. The calf was killed then.
They was in the barn while the calf was killed. And even at that point, we didn't hear any disturbance in the barn. You didn't hear the dogs barking or anything else. And, you know, like I've told Mom, I said, you know, and I've talked to her many times about this since, and especially since I've, you know, gotten real serious about the research and everything. And she said, Bobby, those dogs did not make one sound the night that, you know, Smokey was killed. And she said, you know, she goes, I find it awful, awful, you know, strange that they didn't. And because I talked to her and I'm like, Mom, you know, think about how Smokey was killed. Them dogs, they couldn't reach the center of the barn where Smokey was at. Their leashes wouldn't let them reach that far. And she got to thinking about it. She said, you know, you're right. She goes, you know, that don't make no sense. And I said, well, think about how he was laying. You know, his back was to them and his stomach was laying the opposite direction away from them. And his guts was pulled out in a pile, in a nice neat pile. If they would have killed him, he'd have been the kill area of the calf, the open guts.
Would have been a mess.
Yeah,
would have been a bloody mess.
It would have been towards them, and the guts would have been pulled out, and they wouldn't have had him in a nice pile.
No.
I mean, these things was not scattered at all. And she said, you know, I never thought about it, but you're right. She said, she goes, that don't make no sense because, she goes, you know, we thought that, you know, they had killed the calf. She goes, but, you know, now that you brought it back up and talked about it, she goes, you're right. You know, they didn't kill it. And whatever killed them or killed Smokey, you know, they didn't bark at it. They didn't raise cane or anything. I mean, and she said, they must have been cowering in fear over there while this thing killed your calf.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, that's my point exactly. And then that really, you know, gives you a real strong creep factor about how creepy this really is, you know. And anyway, I went through pretty much, you know, my teenage years. And then when I was 18, I had went to see my oldest brother, you know, stayed at his house and was helping him do some work as a painter. And he was out checking on some more jobs one evening and then, you know, visiting with some of the clients. And I was talking to his wife and I was telling her about this thing that I had seen in the window back in 1969 in Garrison. And she said, Oh, you've got to talk to Gerald. I'm like, do what? She said, you've got to talk to Gerald. I said, what do you mean? And she said, just talk to him when he gets here. And I said, okay. Well, when he got in that evening, we ate dinner and we were sitting in the living room and watching TV. And I said, Gerald, let me ask you something. Marla told me to talk to you about this. But I said, in 1969, when I seen that thing in the window, I said, it's pretty much haunted me my whole life. I said, what do you know about that? He said, Bobby, he said, you know, back in that time frame, he said, you know, that a lot of times I would stay in the boys' room. I wouldn't always sleep in Mama's room. And I'm like, yeah, I remember. And he said, well, some of the times when I slept in the boys' room, he said, in fact, on three different occasions, he said, at the end of the bed, you'd walk around the end of the little old double twin mattress or whatever. You'd walk around the end of it to go to the other side, and there was a window at the foot of it. To the right was some bunk beds. And he said, you know, I was sleeping in my bed, and on three different occasions, something woke me up in the middle of the night, and I raised up and looked at the window, and he said, this thing was in the window showing me its teeth and motioning for me to come to the window. And I said, are you kidding me? He said, no. I said, what did you do? He said, Bobby, each time it done it, I pulled a cover over my head, and I would sit there and shake and cry. And he said, I would say, Mama, Mama, Daddy, Mama, Daddy, Mama, Mama, Daddy. He said, I was doing everything I could to scream, but I couldn't get, he goes, I thought I was screaming, but it wasn't coming out loud. And he said, I would sit there and shake and cry, and I would finally go back to sleep. He said, it did it to me three different times. And I'm like, you know, I said, I hate that it happened to you and you went through that, but I am glad, because I've been telling people about this my whole life, and people are like, well, how do you remember that from 4 years old? I said, you just gave validation to everything I've been saying all these years, you know, because, you know, and I needed that, you know, because that, I mean, I knew what I had seen. I knew what I had encountered, but, you know, people don't think a kid can have that good of a memory on stuff. And he validated everything for me. And I'm like, this is amazing. You know, I mean, it's awesome. Shortly after the calf incident, Mom called Dad offshore. Of course, they did the radio phone thing when you're offshore back then. And she told him, you either come move us away from here, or we're going to move back to the other house that we just moved from. I mean, we wasn't there. I don't think we was there a year. We was there about 10 months at the most. She said, you either come move us out of this place somewhere else, or we're going back to the house that we left. Which was in Livingston, Texas, is where we had came from.
I don't blame her one bit.
Oh, yeah. Mom was having a very hard time with everything then, and she was taking sleep aids to help her sleep. She was a nervous wreck. She was totally a nervous wreck. You had this woman, you know, had four kids, and something was around the house, you know, and you know, she heard the growl, this weird stuff was happening, and then the calf got killed. I seen something in the window. I mean, she just told me, she goes, I was a nervous wreck. And I remember, you know, her taking, you know, all these sleep aids and everything else, and she was doing everything she could to sleep so she didn't have to deal with it, because her nerves were shot. And we had some friends from down the road that was always coming and checking on us, because it was a very crazy time. I watched these movies like, you know, The Legend of Boggy Creek and stuff like that. And the scenes where the thing comes up outside the old house place where you got the women in there and the girl with the baby and everything. And I can relate to that. You know, I can relate to stories of people saying this thing was coming up around our house and, you know, and it was terrorizing this family or that family. I can relate, because my family was terrorized in 1969 by one of these creatures. What I dealt with, I'll be honest with you. I'm 50 years old now, and I will not sleep next to a window that is not completely covered. If a shade is up in any way, I won't sleep near it. I don't care. It's a phobia of mine ever since that. And, you know, we go camping in these areas where the, you know, these things are at and everything, and I'll sleep in a tent. A lot of people may say, oh, you're a big wuss. Not really, I'm not. I'm a pretty big guy. You know, I did the professional wrestling thing, and, you know, I pretty much can handle my own, but this phobia of this has just haunted me. But I won't even sleep in a tent and unzip the window things, you know, for the mesh netting to let the air through. I'll crack it a couple of inches just to get a little bit of air in there. Cause if I woke up and one of these things was sitting there staring at me inside the tent, I'd probably have a heart attack, because that's my biggest phobia of this thing.
And I don't think anyone honestly could blame you for feeling that way, especially going through that as a child. I wanted to ask you, so when the saint, see, I'm of the opinion that these things are not human, that you were dealing with a wild animal, and that, you know, it's a very smart wild animal, but it's a wild animal nonetheless.
Right.
Your description of what it's doing with motioning to you to come to the window is very human-like behavior. And, you know, there's one, I mentioned the cowman story to you, and what happened in that story is the Sasquatch was focused on the little boy. And the little boy would go to his window at night and they'd make faces at each other is what, how the story goes. Which again is very human-like behavior. What do you think its intent was with motioning you to the window? I know you've done all this research and you've had a lot of time to think about it. What do you think its intent was?
A lot of people, you know, they'll have their opinions of it. It didn't mean to do any good. I mean, it meant to do me harm in one way or another. Because, you know, and from my research, I mean, you know, talking to people, they're like, oh, well, you know, they have their young and they, you know, and they'll take human babies to replace the lost young if they lose a young or whatever. And I'm like, well, if this thing wanted me to replace one that it might have lost, then that was harming me because it's taking me out of my natural environment with, you know, with my family and taking me to some strange deal. But in all actuality, I actually believe it was looking for an easy meal. And it's just something that I've come across from my research.
I agree. I think you're easy pickings.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because I'm a kid. I'm not a threat. You know, I'm easy pickings, and it's like my brother. I mean, he was 15. He's a kid. He's a teenager. He's easy pickings. This whole thing about these things being human and everything, people that knows of our group, they know that we actually hunt to harvest one of these things. And back, right after the World Trade Center incident, we had a guy come to our camp to hunt with us, and he was placed in a stand, and he shot one of these things, and I believe he might have hit it in the shoulder, because this thing has been seen several times since, and it holds its left arm up to it as it runs across the fire lanes and stuff on this property. And, you know, we got the blood and everything, and believe me, we tried to find this thing, but it wasn't an exit wound. It had to hit the shoulder and stop. And, you know, it damaged it, but it didn't tear up any internal organs. I mean, it's still alive. The geneticist that did the testing on this was going to charge, it was just under $5,000 to do this, like $4,800 or $4,600. I can't remember the exact figure, but the deal was, is, you know, if it comes out to be human or a known animal, then you're going to pay for it to have all this testing done. Okay, that's fine. The first thing they called back and said was, it's definitely not human. It's like, well, we knew this, you know, because we're not hunting a human, we're hunting an animal. And then they, you know, of course, they tried to match it to all the other known animals in North America, and they said, you know, they couldn't match any of those. And then they tried to match the animals, you know, from Africa and everything else, and they could never find a match on it. It did come out to be, they classified it as an unknown primate, and it fit as a group type, blood group type A is supposed to be the group typing for chimpanzees and orangutans. Group type B is for your gorillas. And this is what I've been told. I haven't did any studying on this. This is what I was told by the people doing the work on it. And they said, this is group type A, but it's neither chimpanzee nor orangutan. They, you know, we was talking about, said, well, you know, this thing is of a higher intelligence than your other normal creatures. And those are your higher intelligent, you know, monkeys and whatnot, your apes and chimpanzees and orangutans are your smarter, more intelligent, you know, apes and whatnot. So finding out that a group type A wasn't a big surprise, but the thing is, it was neither of those. They said it's definitely a primate, but it's an unknown primate.
It matched closest to an orangutan or a chimpanzee, but it wasn't an exact match. But that's what it, is that what they were saying to you?
Well, it was the same blood group type. You had, you know, blood group type A, and it was in that blood group type, but it was neither of those. So, it was in the same blood grouping type, yes, you know, for group type A. And, you know, I'm not familiar with all the scientific and medical terms and stuff on all this blood work and everything, but this is what we was told. You know, we just found it interesting because, you know, the intelligence level of those creatures, and then this creature is, you know, it's definitely an intelligent creature. It does have some intelligence to it. And, you know, we found that very interesting. But then, you know, for people to think, you know, well, this is an ancient human and it's related to man and this and that. No, it's not. I mean, we know for a fact. We've had the blood. We've had it tested. I hate to ruffle any feathers on anybody out there that doesn't want one harmed, but, you know, somebody's got to prove this thing exists.
No, yeah, and you're right. And it's going to take a bottle. It's going to take a body.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot more. There's a bigger picture to this whole thing than just this creature. I mean, people get their feathers ruffled, and they don't want Harry Henderson killed, and, you know, because it's a big, lovable fuzzy. And no, it's not. Some of the aggressive displays that I've encountered, you know, it's not the creatures that people say, oh, it doesn't, you know, it's just shy and elusive. If it sees you, it'll walk away. No, it doesn't always do that. And I think, depending on the creature and what circumstance you catch it in, I think they're like humans. You know, you have some humans that are bad humans. They're just mean.
Right.
And then you have some humans that are very passive, and they, you know, they don't want any confrontation with anybody. They're just very passive humans. But then you have some humans that, man, if you even turn around and accidentally make eye contact, man, they're ready to jump on you and hurt you. And, you know, we got prison systems full of bad people. So
yeah, and even primates are that way. I mean, it's amazing. Exactly. Chimpanzees are the exact same way.
And I think these creatures are no different. I think, you know, that, you know, you've got some that are passive, that at all costs they'll avoid, you know, any contact with humans. And you got some that they're just bad. And, you know, you read stories about, you know, like that, was it, that 411, 411 books or whatever.
Right. Missing 411.
Yeah, that's it. He talks, you know, about the, you know, these kids coming up missing and whatnot. You know, I've always suspected these things of doing harm to humans if given the opportunity. Because I've always said there was opportunist, and if the right situations, you know, existed, that they would hurt somebody. And, you know, reading those stories and that, it's like, wow, you know, that's interesting. It's eye-opening, and people really need to take note here on these creatures. You know, people goes out there and, you know, well, I don't carry anything for protection. They're not going to hurt me. That is a wrong idea to go with on these things. You don't know what these things are thinking. You have no idea. And to go out there without any protection at all, that's like going into grizzly bear country and not carrying protection. You know, you may encounter a grizzly bear and it just walks on by, but you may get attacked.
Right.
You know, you're dealing with a wild animal. That's the whole, it's a wild animal and you don't know what this thing's going to do. And we know more about bears and everything else than we do this creature, you know, and we know bears will attack you. These things right here, you don't know what they're going to do. It's still an unknown. To go out there with a mindset that they won't do anything to you, it's totally crazy. And for people to say, well, if you got a gun on you, they can sense your intentions and you won't see them. Really? I mean, I've had guns on me every time that I've seen one, except for the when I was a kid and I didn't have a gun on me then. It was in the middle of the night. You know, I was 4 years old.
You bring up a really good point. I've never bought into the whole they see your intention thing because, you know, there's so many hunters that run into these things, you know, and they're armed to the teeth and they run into these things. These things don't seem to be too, you know, afraid of running into someone who's armed. Although I'm kind of torn. I still think they know what a weapon is. I still think that they know, what a weapon is, but I don't think that's necessarily going to detract them from, if they want to come in and mess with you, they're going to come in and mess with you, whether you have a gun or not. I wanted to ask you, though, will you talk a little bit about some of the stranger or maybe more aggressive encounters you've either investigated or you've been out in the field and you've experienced?
I'll tell you of a really good encounter we had. It's going to go from one end to another because it was the same area. I had a gentleman with me. Some of y'all may know him because he's done a little bit on some TV stuff, Chester Moore Jr. And he's the editor of Texas Fish and Game. He used to hunt with us, and we had an area in Polk County. It wasn't too far from the Indian Reservation, close to Livingston, but it was, you know, a little ways away from there. It wasn't too awfully far, though. We got access to some property where there's, you know, we was told that these creatures had, you know, been there, you know, for years and years, and this one gentleman had built a camp house up there, and he had had encounters, and he wasn't going up there anymore. And he said, look, you can go up there and, you know, do whatever you want to do. And I'm like, awesome. You know, so we head up there, and it was Chester and his dad and myself. And we had when we first started, you know, going there, the deal was in which, you know, we looked around for sign. We seen a few little, you know, interesting things, but we didn't see a lot. And it's like, well, I don't know. So we did a nighttime investigation, and you know, after we look around and everything, we'll sit there at night and build a fire. You know, of course, it was extremely cold. You know, it was in the winter months, and you know, we'll build a fire and we'll sit there and we'll just listen. You know, for hours and hours, we'll listen to see if we hear anything. And you know, we did this, and early in the night, we heard one sound holler out as it kind of went around going through the bottom. At a creek bottom, and it's like, okay, heard it once, and then we didn't hear anything else, and it sounded like it was pretty far off, and it's like, well, I guess it went around us, you know, but, I mean, we heard something, but, you know, I guess it's all the activity we're going to get. Well, I don't know, it was about 3:30, 4-ish in the morning. It was really, really late, or early, however you want to look at it, and we got ready to leave. And I was backed up closest to the fire, and it was one lane in, and they was in front of me, and it was Chester and his dad. And we got ready to leave, and we put all our gear up. You know, I put all the recording, you know, equipment I had up, the bionic ear and my little cassette recorder I had hooked to it, and put up my night vision and got everything in the truck, and Chester and his dad got everything loaded in their truck, and then Chester's dad got a big old 5-gallon bucket of water out of his truck and came up there, and we poured it on the fire, putting it out before we left. Well, we got it put out, and we was walking back up by my truck, and right as we got by my door and we were saying our goodbyes, to the left of us, and it was less than 50 foot away, you hear this. I said, wow. You hear that? And Chester goes, oh, yeah. I'm like, just be quiet. Let's just listen. And then you hear it again. And I'm like, okay, I haven't really experienced this before. This is interesting. So let's see what happens. So I said, I'm going to try something. So I growled back. I go, and when I did, this thing, it goes, and it started working itself up, and it went into that one scream that you'll hear on that movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek, that echoes to the bottoms and everything. It went into a scream that sounded like that, and then it stopped as it started to scream, and it went back down to a low growl. And went, well, I growled back, and this thing worked itself back up again, and then Chester growled, and then it did it again, and we had this exchange for, I don't know, we probably worked it up about 7 or 8 times doing this. And I'm like, guys, my gun's in the truck. Y'all's guns are in the truck. So if this thing comes on us, one of us is fixing to have to cut this thing, you know, while the other one gets a gun or something, because this is going to be bad. You know, I mean, because, you know, you don't know what this thing's going to do. And, you know, it was our early stages and early years of research and trying to figure some of this stuff out. Well, after about 8 times of this thing, you know, working itself up doing this, it would just growl that, and it was getting quieter and quieter, like it was leaving. We didn't hear it come up and we didn't hear it leave. But it was getting further away, and then we just got to where we didn't hear it at all. And we waited a while and didn't hear anything else. We'd growl and everything and, you know, never heard it no more. And so we left and said, okay, I'll call you tomorrow. We'll, make some more plans of what we're going to do next. Well, the neighbor earlier that night had came over and met us, and he says, hey, I've got this land over here, on the other side of the house, all down through that creek bottom and the other side of that. Y'all are welcome to go over there and do whatever you want to do. Like, awesome. This is fantastic. Well, so our plan was we went back, we made a date to go back. So we went, and Chester bought a friend of his. His name was Patrick. I'm not going to say his last name. I don't know if he wants it, out there. But Patrick was with us, and we went about a quarter mile back off into the woods down this creek bottom, and it had a whole bunch of pine in there. And we got off in the pines and set up camp. And there was a good area there where we could, had a little open area for a fire and everything and set up our tent and whatnot. Well, right as it got dusky dark, right at dusk, just before dark, we started hearing limbs snapping all around us. I mean, it was everywhere, but we couldn't see anything. It's like, well, they're here, but I just don't see them, and they're letting us know they're here and they don't like us being here. And, of course, we're looking, we're straining our eyes to see any movement. We're not seeing anything. This goes on, for about 20 minutes we're hearing this, and then everything got quiet. We got the fire going, everything's set up. We're sitting around the fire, relaxing, and I want to say it was about 10 or 10:30. I can't remember the exact time. I posted the report and I put the times in there when it happened. Back off further down in the bottom, and it echoed through there up our way. If you get a chimpanzee worked up, a chimpanzee would do that type of sound.
Right.
And that has to be noted here, because if you take that and put it in a big old huge gorilla and do the same sound, it's really deep. From a big barrel chest is going, and it's just, I can't even get as deep as this thing, but that sound come echoing out of that bottom. I looked over at Chester and his dad. I said, did y'all hear that? And they're like, yeah, how could we miss it? I said, I have never heard this thing make us these things or any of these creatures during any of my outings make a sound anything like this. I said, that is definitely a primate sound. And everything was quiet after that. We didn't hear anything else. And it was probably about 1:30, 2-ish in the morning. It was really cold, really extremely cold. And I said, guys, it was about 30 minutes, before I got ready to crash. I went in there and started the tent heater, started getting some of the chill out of the tent. And about 30 minutes later, I said, guys, I'm going to bed. I said, man, nothing's happening. I think we done had all we're going to have happen tonight, so I'm going to crash. Well, I go to get in the tent, and as I'm zipping it down, the zipper goes back up, and here comes Chester and his dad and Patrick. We, get all up in the tent, and I'm sleeping against one of the side walls of the tent. My head is towards the door. Patrick is sleeping with his head at the opposite end, and Chester and his dad's on the other side of him, and their heads are at the other end. And anyway, it needs to be noted, it's extremely quiet. I mean, we're way out in the woods, a long ways from any type of major road or regularly used farm market road or anything. I mean, it is way out. And then you go down a dirt road, and it dead ends to this place where we're at, and then we're still, at least a quarter of a mile off in the woods from there. And it's in the winter months, and you can hear you know, it's so quiet you can hear a little bit of a winter breeze blowing through the trees at times, but it's just deathly quiet. There's no sounds whatsoever. Well, we get in the tent, and it's just a couple of minutes after we all get in the tent, you hear limb snapping coming towards us. You hear them snap, 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 and they're getting louder because they're coming towards us. And I'm like, well, guys, they're coming to see us. And I said, y'all just be quiet. Let's see what happens. Well, after just just a couple of minutes, it wasn't long, right in front of the tent, you hear,
Jesus.
I'm like, oh, boy. You know?
Yeah,
and
I don't blame you. My God.
Exactly. And, I mean, it was right in front of the tent. I mean, if it was 20 foot, it would have surprised me. It was right there. And I had my .44 Magnum laying beside me, and I raised up and turned around, and I had my hand on it and had it, you know, kind of pointing towards the doorway of the tent. You know, that's the area that it was at, is in the front of the tent. And it growled again. And I told Chester, I said, Chester, do not growl back at this thing. He said, why not? I said, because if that thing jumps on the tent, one of us might get shot. I mean, there's four of us in here. And if it jumps on the tent, I'm going to start shooting. You know, I mean, you don't know what this thing's going to do. Don't growl at it. Well, it growled several times, and we're just sitting there. And I'm not going to lie. I mean, my insides was jittery. I mean, because it's that excitement and adrenaline and everything's all wrapped up. You know, I was nervous. I mean, I get scared like anybody else. Yeah, I hunt these things, but I also have a healthy respect for them because, you know, they're a wild animal. They're very, very large wild animals. So I'm sitting here and my insides are quivering, you know, and I'm just like, oh boy, here we go, you know. And so this thing growled for a little bit and then it got real quiet and we didn't hear anything. And I'm like, okay, maybe it moved on. And I eased my head, laid back down. I'm laying there. I've still got my pistol in my hand. And then I hear pine needles slowly crackling under the weight as it slowly put its foot down to try not to make any noise. And it was coming around the tent. And I said, the thing's coming around the tent. And Chester said, how do you know? I said, I can hear it placing its weight real light. It was light as it could and real slowly as it eased its weight down on these dry pine needles by the tent. You know, you can hear them crackling under the weight of its, you know, foot as it put it down. And, I said, it's coming around the tent, guys. And it was a few seconds later. I'm not going to use the word that Patrick used. I will use another word in the term and y'all will understand the word he used and why I'm not going to say it, you know, on an interview or anything, but out of nowhere, you hear Patrick say, he's by my freaking head. And it was like a kid crying out in the wilderness for help, you know, when he said that. And
what did he say? It was grabbing his head?
Yeah, it was by his head. And, he, you know, his head was at the other end of the tent from where mine was. And when he did that, I mean, we're nervous. Our insides are jittery.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Chester and myself and Chester's dad, Chester Sr., we just busted out laughing. And I mean, we're laughing hysterically. I mean, it's a very tense moment. Adrenaline's pumping. Our insides are jittery and shaky because we don't know what's fixing to happen. But when he did that, it's like this little helpless cry in the wilderness crying for help, you know, and we just busted out laughing. And amongst the laughter, finally got it. Well, how do you know it's by your head? He said, because I've got my head's laid up next to a root back here, and I felt his foot bump the root. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, everything was quiet. We didn't hear anything else, you know. And so we all lay there a while. We talked a little bit, and, you know, we'd listen and listen, and we talked a little bit, and nothing happened. We managed to finally doze off and got about an hour's worth of sleep. And right as it was starting to break daylight, you know, we all come crawling out of the tent and go over and start the fire up and get it going real good. Well, after it got good enough daybreak where we could see it was going to start breaking down the tent and everything, get ready to leave. And Chester went around back to the tent. And he said, Bob, you need to come look at this. I'm like, okay. And I walked around there, and 4 inches, exactly 4 inches from the back of the tent, right there in the area where Patrick's head was laying, there was an 18-inch impression.
Oh, Jesus.
Back there. And I believe Chester casted it, but there was an 18-inch footprint 4 inches from the back of the tent. That was totally wild. I mean, just the whole adrenaline rush and everything. And, you know, I've been back a couple of times, haven't had no good encounters since then. And of course, the gentleman that owned that property, he sold it to somebody else, so we don't have access to that anymore. But that's another one of the wild adventures that we had.
Yeah, no kidding. Do you think it was the same creature from the night before that you and Patrick were growling at? Do you think it kind of came back and watched?
Yeah, Chester. Yeah, Chester and I, the one we was growling at.
Yeah.
I believe it was. You know, it was the same growl. It was doing the same growl that it was doing, you know, and it wasn't the night before. It was a couple of weeks before. If memory serves me right, it was at least 2 or 3 weeks, because we, you know, we'd, you know, get the time set up with each other to be able to get back over there at the same time, you know, with our schedules. And, but it was Chester and I that was growling at, and it was growling back. And, you know, he brought Patrick with him. You know, Patrick was one of his good friends that was interested in this stuff, and he came with him along with his dad. It sounded like the same growl that it was doing. So I do believe it was the same creature. And, you know, we was further back in the woods, and so, you know, it came up closer to us, but it didn't do it till after we got, you know, in the tent all zipped up. And, you know, the thought was going through my head, you know, when it was growling in front, I'm like, well, you know, do I unzip the tent and stick my head out, you know, and try to get a shot with my pistol? I mean, what do I do? And, you know, from experience, at that time that I'd already had in dealing with some of these things, if you have one that's like that, that's coming in close and showing some aggressive behavior, if it thinks that you're not scared of it, it won't mess with you anymore. It will not mess with you. And my mind is racing. I'm like, if I go to unzip the tent, it's probably going to run off. And we may not get a chance like this again. So, you know, if we don't come out of the tent, you know, we might be able to come back and be able to set up and get a repeat performance, but be able to have it set up to where we can actually see it and it not see us being able to see it. And then we, you know, might be able to get a shot, you know, maybe this way. So, you know, 'cause I've had people ask me, why do you just unzip the tent and go out? Well, I didn't want to let this thing realize, hey, you know, these cats may not be scared of me, so, you know, I'm not going to mess with them.
Well, and the other thing, too, I don't think people quite understand, because I've heard the growl, too, and it kind of threw me when your mother had said it was a demonic growl, because really that's how I have said that's the type of growl I remember. I remember it being kind of a demonic growl and enough to shake you up. And when you're sitting in the tent, this thing comes right up and starts growling at you. I find it interesting it waited till all of you guys went in the tent and then came up. It probably sat and watched you guys all go in the tent, then decided to come play the tough guy routine of coming up and growling on you guys.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, because, you know, we was all out around the fire, and we didn't put the fire out. I mean, we was in an area, the way it was cleared out where the fire wasn't, it was contained. You know, it was in a, and we had our own little, I guess you would kind of call it a fire pit in a way, the way we had, you know, some stones and stuff around it to where the fire was contained. It wasn't going to get out. So we, you know, and it had burned down pretty low. And so we just, you know, left it and went to get in the tent. And so, I mean, it's sitting out there in the woods. And, you know, as soon as we all got in the tent and got settled, you could hear it coming. It started breaking limbs coming through the woods towards us. And there's no doubt it sat out there and watched us till everybody got in the tent. And then, you know, it let us know it was coming. It was making noise. And, yeah. You know, it was a very interesting encounter. It's one of the more exciting ones that I like to tell, because people's like, oh, I'll do this and that. Okay. I've had grown men with me in camp on some of my outings, and these things have came up, and they had to leave at 3 a.m, and they won't go back. You know, I mean, you know,
yeah.
So, you know, you don't know what you're going to do until you have some of this stuff happen to you. And I always tell people, you know, I have a strong desire for answers, and that's why I do this. And, you know, and I have people say, well, you know, I'd leave, I'd run, I'm like, why do you run from something you're trying to find? To me, that's never made any sense. Do I get spooked? Yeah, I get spooked. You know, I mean, you're dealing with something that's still an unknown, but don't run from something that you're looking for. I mean, that's not how you find something. And like I said, I've had grown men that's, you know, that's left in the middle of the night, and they won't come back. You know, it's just too much for them to deal with.
This is part one of a two-part interview with Bobby Hamilton. Hope everyone can join us tomorrow night as we wrap it up with Bobby. He's going to be sharing some more encounter stories with us, along with going into his TV show, Killing Bigfoot. Until tomorrow night, everyone, I hope you have a great night. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I will see you tomorrow night.